Okay, page 97. The same teachings that we've just read about have serious implications for our understanding of what the relationship between parents and children become in a Christian family. And we notice that here, again, as with marriage. In other words, we are not depending on what we might call the natural love of a parent for a child based on biology and the psychology of self-love, which encourages us to think of our children as extensions of ourselves. The spiritual advice that we're being given in this text is not simply advice that fits in with a worldly understanding of things. It goes beyond that. There's something good about the worldly understanding of things if it's not self-love and hurtful to the other person, but it doesn't go beyond that natural love without spiritual effort. Here too, as with the relationship between a man and a woman, what we might think of as a natural love, biologically based, psychologically based, having nothing to do with a shared pursuit of purity of heart and the love of God, that kind of love doesn't come along with the birth of a child any more than the biological and psychological passion for a member of the opposite sex yields the Christian love that has to have a beginning and spiritual effort. It has a lot to do with struggle against vice and for a love of the other person the way God loves us. That is a different kind of love, whether we're talking about a spouse or whether we're talking about children. And maybe whether we're talking about the love of children for their parents.
We start where we're at and we move toward love. There's a sense here too that what the relationship between parents and children become. You know, like I can think of, say, in the classical world in Rome, the father had the power of life and death over every member of the family. There was no question about where authority lay. It started out that way. The potential husband went to the home of the woman and brought her from where she was and took her to his home and carried her across the threshold. That's where it comes from, that idea of carrying the person over the threshold. You were in that home, now you're in this home, and the father is the authority, and that's the way it is. That idea comes from pagan Rome, not from the New Testament or even the Old Testament. Sometimes people blame the patriarchal family, but even the idea of a marriage as a contract comes from pagan Rome. It starts there. Because the idea was that you start with however the society does things, and you move from there on. Now, in the Christian East, there's something similar, but it doesn't start with that idea of a authoritarian, male-dominated marriage. And I don't mean by that there was feminism. What I mean by that is that, as we said last week, we start with the kind of love that two people have for one another in marriage. That's brought into the church, and the understanding is that from there you move toward the fullness of a Christian love. The point being that if you start with the pagan Roman model of authority of the husband and father in the family, you start out knowing how things are going to be. It's based on the authority of the husband and father. As Christians, we start out and need to move towards something that our understanding is we don't have yet. It is not already fulfilled by the marriage contract or by the authority of the husband and father, or something that already exists in the beginning. You have something that needs to be fulfilled. This is just the same as our understanding of the way it was in the beginning, in the Garden of Eden. Things were good, but there was potential for human beings to be like God in a fulfilled way. So it's the same thing with marriage, and it's the same thing here with children too. You don't establish a Christian family because you have done the right ritual, and the authority is in the father and the mother, and then go on from that foundation. Our understanding is that foundation is Christ, and we are unequal to Christ. We are called to attain toward, move toward the fullness of the stature of Christ. that goes for each one of us as Christians. It goes for us as far as the kind of love that we understand, that we've been talking about here, the way God loves us. We are called to love one another and to love God. And there's going to be spiritual development. There's going to be movement. It's never going to be completely accomplished. It becomes more and more Christ-like, more and more divine. Same thing in terms of our relationship between parents and children. The secular model of I am the father, I am the mother, I have the authority, you do what I tell you to do, is not what we're going to be talking about. There's something else. There's something else. Now, there has to be respect, of course, yes. But, you know, and that comes up in a page or so. So it's a matter of what the relationships between parents and children must become in a Christian family. While there are many images of what an ideal parent and child relationship should look like in today's world, none of them resemble in any way a Christian friendship based on purity of heart, humility, and absolute unity in striving for the kingdom of God. That's our understanding of the nature of a Christian friendship. It applies to marriage, and it also applies to the relationship between parents and children. Often, even among Christians, children are presented as creations of their parents. Now, the Roman pagan model of the family would agree with that. Virtual non-entities, that is, not already persons themselves, which if we've had children and we've had more than one child, we know that they're all completely different. Completely different. You know, as part, we have one child, we think, I always used to say, Sharon and I had Elizabeth and Kathy, we had two girls, we thought we were great parents, and then we had boys. And we found out we didn't know anything. And not only did we not know anything because they weren't girls, they were boys, every single one of them completely different. Now, Elizabeth and Kathy, they are totally different, that's for sure. But somehow it had not dawned on us until we had children of the opposite gender. So they're not simply our creations where we try to make them more and more like us. We are all husband, wife, children, boys and girls, sons and daughters, called to become like Christ, not like the parents. They're already the genes, the mother and the father, biologically, physically, personality-wise, they've got plenty that comes from the parents. They don't need to be molded into images of their parents. We can't even mold them into images of God, likenesses of God. There is another dynamic that we're going to describe in these next few pages that's different from that. They are not just nobodies whose character, belief, conduct, and future are dictated entirely by those who raise them. There are Christian parents, even Orthodox Christian parents, who think that that's the way it ought to be. And when they are not able to accomplish that because they're dealing with other human beings and they don't get any support for that idea from Orthodox spiritual life, then sometimes they feel like they've failed. They are seen as lumps of clay to be molded this way or that for the purpose of building a particular kind of person who will be able to succeed according to a given set of standards or criteria, sometimes including religious criteria. Criteria, standards that happen to be valued by the parents and community. So we're rejecting all of these ways of understanding relationship between parents and children. The basic understanding of that kind is that parents control this process of molding, and success is defined by the degree to which the eventual product meets a particular standard of what is desirable. Parental choices are in turn judged on the quality of the product they produce in the same way that a craftsman's technique is judged by his work. Abba Joseph's teaching demands that Orthodox Christians approach the work of parenting in a completely different way. The goal must be not the molding of a particular kind of successful adult product, but the development of a true Christian friendship between parent and child. Now, there is a secular version of this that we would also reject. It's not that I'm going to be your buddy. That's not what we're talking about. The friendship, the Christian friendship that we're talking about, is the kind of Christian friendship that we've been describing for the previous almost 100 pages. If we forget what that is, then we're not going to know what this means. So let's not mistake it for that secular idea that mother and daughter were girlfriends. It's not that, something else altogether. True Christian friendship built on genuine love that is shared purity of heart. So we have some ideas about what love is, but we've been talking specifically about how Christian friendship is a matter of a shared goal of purity of heart, and genuine love exists when there is a shared purity of heart. And we'll remind ourselves of the meaning of those terms in just a minute. Such a friendship, it goes nearly without saying, will not resemble what is commonly called friendship in secular society. It won't be a relationship of two social peers, for children are not the peers, other friends of the same age, they're not equals. There's the parent, and then there's the son and the daughter. They're not peers. They're not peers in age, knowledge, or wisdom. Parents and children will not become buddies. Mom and dad won't be perceived as cool and with it most of the time. The friendship between parents and child will remain imbalanced in regards to knowledge until those children become adults themselves, also in regards to power over decision making. Remember that the relationship between husband and wife, it wasn't a matter of power and control. The relationship between parents and children, there is authority of a kind that we'll talk about in a minute, but it's not primarily about power, except to protect the child to the point that they've reached the point that they have the ability to make their own decisions. That's not the center of things. There's a way in which we don't just gain the ability to exercise our own capacity for rational decision making. There is also the way in which we become more and more like Christ. That's not a matter of my power, my decision making, my making practical choices. Children can learn those things from their parents, but there is a more interactive way of reaching the point where you share the goal of a shared purity of heart. It's not the same sort of thing. And so children grow up and reach the point that they are adult peers of their parents when it comes to practical decision making, and even then there is a parent and child relationship. Although, you know what, this idea that you have to back off when your children become adults and not be so overt was really always there, as I think will become apparent on the next page when we start to talk about discernment, knowing when to intervene, knowing when to say something, as far as the common goal of purity of heart. It can't be something that can be taught by imposing it or saying, do it this way. It's got to be this kind of relationship where we give in to the other person in order to have a kind of love that works back and forth that we described before. That doesn't just start when the children are biologically adults. It's in the nature of what we're going to describe. And I probably shouldn't be contrasting it until we get to it, but I couldn't keep myself from it. But he did say, until those children become adults themselves in regards to power over decision making. And that in regards to power over decision making, you could put that in parentheses. That's the practical level of things. Children grow up and we have to back off and let them make their own decisions. Otherwise, we just try to keep them children. That's no good. Okay. Yet the Christian parent-child relationship, if it is to live up to the ideal presented by Abba Joseph, will always and necessarily be a nascent, something that isn't completely accomplished, but is still kind of at the beginning. The way, you know, when we read spiritual writings, it seems like we're always starting. We're always starting wherever we are and moving beyond where we are. And so it's nascent. It's still in the bud, yet to become fully flowering. A nascent and growing Christian friendship, a friendship that isn't yet what it can be and never will fully be what it can be because it's always growing and developing, and thus will always be a relationship between two people. Okay, children, I'm going to start skipping a little bit more. Children are people. Children are real human beings of their own. Real relationships of love exist only between genuine human agents. Even if a differential, even if there is a difference between wisdom and power that are necessarily present. So here's a reference to the practical level of things where parents are more experienced. They know how to do things. Children don't have experience. They're not worldly wise as far as how things work in the world. They will eventually gain that. So there's a differential there between the parent who has that kind of experience and biological and psychological maturity, and the child who doesn't yet. So there is that difference, that differential, when it comes to wisdom and power. But more to the point, unity of purpose is accomplished not when these two agents outwardly resemble one another in some particular ability or capacity, nor is it achieved when a child lives up to the expectations of a parent. That is, not becoming more adult to become like the parent. Conversely, it's not precluded when a child falls short of a parent's worldly ideal, nor is it made impossible when he or she fails to meet the expectations of a particular worldly community. Unity of purpose is achieved when two people strive together for purity of heart in humility and thus make the kingdom of God literally manifest within themselves, so that we become free spiritual and moral agents who are able to act when it's not clear what needs to be done. You know, we have moral and spiritual responsibility. Human beings have capacity to bring more evil into the world. You know, discipline is necessary. You know, we can't just let ourselves go and act according to our passions and bring evil into the world that didn't exist there before. Some secularly minded people who reject the Christian faith in particular think that that's the nature of freedom, the fact that we can act in such a way that we're governed by our passions and desires. We reject that. Okay. The first step to develop unity of purpose with our children is to practice the virtues and thus cultivate purity of heart in ourselves. Sometimes parents feel like they want to try to get their children to act according to a certain worldly standard, as was just talked about in the previous page. What's being emphasized here is that we cannot function as parents who have a shared goal with our children to develop a purity of heart in common with them if we are not working on developing purity of heart ourselves by practicing the virtues and cultivating purity of heart on our own. So that's the first step. That's where it begins. You can't share what you're not committed to. The object is to bring our children into that sharing of something that we already share between husband and wife and with other members of the Christian community, but especially in the family between husband and wife. Parenting in a spiritual way goes beyond just practical training in judgment and power and how to use it. If it's going to be a Christian friendship, it's got to do with this sharing of purity of heart. We have to already be on that path. Our commitment has to be to that. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. That's where I thought I was going to start. So that's a good place to stop. What do people think?
It's right, as a ring of truth about it, you know, and but I think that this idea of molding children as clay, that's something that I was directly taught. And I heard that directly taught, not even indirectly. People weren't even embarrassed about it. That's what they said. This is the way it should be done.
Right.
And
then we get very disappointed when we've done all this molding and they turn out to
be completely different
than what we wanted them to be, what we thought we were molding them to
be. Well, what I kind of hoped is what they would do is ignore the bad stuff and really focus on the good stuff and do better. But it seemed like sometimes it did the opposite. And I can tell you that all of my children were raised in a very similar place, but they're so different from one another. I mean, the differences between Adam and Benjamin, you all know Adam and Benjamin. They're just completely different people. And Rebecca and Rachel are different people. And Anastasia is 100% Anastasia. She does not like anybody else in particular. And so, you know, I see that. And I think it's, you know, we have some conventions that are built like when a child is 18, they're an adult in our...
Why?
And it's kind of sort of a random, I mean, an arbitrary moment, but when we've set that up in our culture as being that's the moment. It's incredible to me that that some people are ready to go at 15, really, to take care of themselves at 15 and take care of others.
At a practical level, we're talking about.
At a practical level, right. And sometimes, you know, at some other levels, too, in terms of maturity. And then there are other people that are, much older and aren't ready to do that. I had a question about it one time. I used to wonder, why is it that the most important decisions we make in our lives, the ones that affect us the most, we have to make those at a time when it seems like we're least prepared to make a good decision between the ages of 15 and 25?
Maybe because they're not practical decisions. Maybe because they're, as spiritual decisions, they come out of whatever spiritual condition we are at that point. And this can work two ways. It could be that we make a choice, a spiritual and moral choice, that doesn't turn out to be a very good one. It can also be that we make a good one, and it's a kind of a source of amazement, because how could a good choice have been made by such an ignorant and foolish person who does not know the ways of the world, can't support themselves yet? It can go either way. And so what I'm saying is that those decisions come out of the totality of the spirituality of the person. They're not practical decisions. Matters of worldly wisdom and power, or ability to make a wise, practical choice. There's something else. There's an expression of however the person is in terms of what do they love. Do they love the objects of passionate concern for themselves and the world? Or is there a desire to be beyond ourselves, to be noble? And that's a key word. I'm saying that on purpose because I know it means something to you. Where we make a noble choice that is not self-aggrandizing. And it's a foolish choice at a practical level. And yet it's a good moral choice to be made so young. It's surprising. So why is it that those choices are made young? Well, maybe, why is it that way? Why do we send children to war? They think they're invincible. They're willing to go and do whatever it takes. And it's like they don't have the practical constraints of the realization of consequences. And they are maybe bold enough to choose to do the good thing, even if it's not beneficial selfishly. So there's a nobility about young people that we tend to, it's hard to hang on to as we get older. So I think there is a spiritual quality that is there, even though the person is, at a practical level, inexperienced and maybe unable to make good, practical decisions.
Well, as I struggle with that question, and that's all exactly on point, but what I wanted to say about it was, what I think I understand it to be is that those people... The thing that is rewarded is humility. So if people between the ages of 15 and 25 listen, and if they have good leaders, if they have good adults around them, that are trying to lead them, like we're talking about here, then...
I don't remember talking about that.
No, I'm saying why about the age, making decisions in that time, if people will have...
Good leaders.
No, not leaders. Good adults around them. I mean, friends. How can we
well,
say?
Well, that means something in particular.
If they have humility and will listen to those people who are advising them, their parents, their priests, those people, then they can make some really good decisions. They have to say, well, okay, I'm going to humble myself. This is what I want to do, but this is what the advice I'm being given. I should take this. Humility is rewarded in those cases, I think, in ways that... helps me to make sense out of why people are put in the position to make those decisions about what they're going to do. And maybe these are practical decisions, but they can...
Maybe another reason I think is very closely related is that what we're talking about here is moral and spiritual freedom. We're never more free than we are when we are young. It's a spiritual test. Which way will you go? You're completely free. You're not constrained by you don't have children, you don't have great responsibilities usually, you know,
right.
When you're young. It is a pure choice of freedom. We're only truly free, of course, when we choose good, when we choose God, when we choose virtue. If we choose the opposite way, we become less and less free. Mm-hmm. And in which way we choose comes out of the person, comes out of their heart. It's a moral and spiritual choice. And we make those kinds of choices most when we're young. I think that's part of the reason why. Instead of, now, let's say we, what if it were different? What if we could somehow be protected until we were 35 or 40? And we've developed all kinds of practical understanding, and then we made those moral, spiritual choices. Chances are we would rely on our practical, worldly wisdom. Because that's the only thing we have that we didn't have when we were 17 or 18 or 19. And it's not about that. It's never, the right choice is never going to be made on the basis of the practical experience that we don't have when we're 17. If we're 45 and we have loads of practical experience, we're less free because we're more committed to this worldly way of understanding the meaning of life. So it has to be when you're young. And if you choose wrong, you've got the rest of your life to sort it out, you know, because it's not going to go away. It's going to keep coming back to you. You deal with that the rest of your life. So I think that's why. I think that way of thinking of it fits in with what we're talking about here. Because it's not something that we learn by learning practical knowledge and the way of the world. We still don't have it, if that's what we've got.
You know, even if we did, you're talking about making those decisions later. There are certain decisions, if we don't make them early, we still wouldn't have even any practical understanding of when we're 45. You know, because there are certain things you only learn by bumping your head and jumping in and doing
right.
it. You know, I mean, there's certain things we still wouldn't quite, you know, that's what they meant. You know, I don't know that would change if you waited till you were 40 or 45. So, you know, there would be some, you know, some things. But
yeah.
I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful picture that he's painting there for us to look at and see a way to approach parenting that I haven't seen before. I haven't seen it put like this in another place. I don't know if you have or I've missed that.
No, I haven't. I haven't. I think it's exceptional. First step, practice the virtues and cultivate purity of heart ourselves, the mother and the father. If they are not doing this, close the book. There's no sense. You can't go further. That's where you have to start. Your children cannot share what you are not prioritizing, because this has got to be the goal. If it's the goal, if there are other goals that are more important than this, then this won't be the goal. The telos, the kingdom of God, and the immediate goal, purity of heart, it is accomplished when the soul is in a state of not being controlled by the passions. That's purity of heart. Well, that doesn't occur if that's not made the goal and the orientation is not toward the kingdom of God. We're talking about a Christian relationship between parents and children. This is why Basil the Great and his sister, the fact that their parents were saints, and Basil and his brother Gregory of Nyssa and his sister Macrina, they were saints, and you know it they got this from their parents because they shared in common this central goal of purity of heart between the parents and the children, the brothers and the sister. So that's this. It's not like it's only shareable amongst saints. You don't have to be saints. You just need to be oriented, moving in that direction. The kingdom of God as the ultimate goal, as the telos, the end, and the goal of sharing purity of heart. So long as we're rightly oriented and moving, This is a reality. That's all that's necessary. Right orientation toward the telos and movement in that direction. The spiritual fathers tell us we are always moving one direction or another. It's not possible to stand still. So if we are rightly oriented and moving in that direction, however halting that movement may be, we've had a couple examples like the spiral and alternating current, however halting that movement might be, as long as there's orientation and movement, there will be some understanding of that experience that our children can share. That's, I think, an encouraging thing that I believe is true.
Path of the squiggle.
The path of the squiggle. To develop this unity of purpose with our children, we have to practice the virtues and thus cultivate purity of heart ourselves. This is the necessary starting point in all our relationships. But when it comes to children, it's doubly important because children naturally emulate their parents when they are young, and they will emulate us in this if we're doing it, and often begin to do this again when they start to become adults, because when you get to be 18 or 19, you're not sure how to go about being an adult. You start to try to figure that out. As one of my children said to me one day, very frustrated with me, as I was frustrated with that child, not doing things as I thought he or she ought to do, you know I'm going to end up doing it like that in the end anyway. You know, I thought, well, gee, you know, that's encouraging. No, I mean, I'm not sure I believe it, you know, but the fact that they believe it is probably a good thing, you know.
I heard that exact same thing. That's
so funny. And often, in fact, even while they are teenagers, they emulate their parents at least a little, if often secretly. I mean, after all, you know, you're trying to be yourself, right? And the funny thing is, you don't really have to try to be yourself because you're stuck with it. I've gotten in the habit of thinking of it that way. You can't escape the fact that you are who you are. You don't have anything else to work with. It's not like you've got a choice. Of course, my boys, they all grow up playing Dungeons and Dragons, and they would make meticulous lists of all the different characteristics they could have as this character, that character, and another character. And the real truth is, you are who you are, whether you like it or not. You can play this game where you choose this identity and all these particular characteristics. You still are whoever you happen to be. So you need to get better, get good at being who you are. That takes a lot of effort. Dungeons and Dragons does too. They spend days doing this stuff. Thus, as we cultivate purity of heart and take the first step toward unity of purpose with our children, we are accomplishing much the same cultivation within our children as well, and thereby guiding them to the same first step. So if we're out working with our kids and they learn how to build something, you know, by building something along with us, it's similar in the sense that if we are doing this, if we are struggling to practice the virtues and cultivate purity of heart and move in this direction, our children will pick up on that and try to do the same thing. But we have to be doing that. We can't just tell them, do as I say, not as I do. Forget that. They will do as you do and find new and more devastating ways to go about it just to show you up. You think you did it, boy. Look at this. I know about that part. Okay, we stand as in an echo chamber where what we nurture in ourselves is nurtured in our children. Wow, that's it right there. What we nurture in ourselves by our moral and spiritual choices. We can go and confess these things, but if we continue to nurture them, our children will do it too. Even if we go to confession and confess them, we continue doing them, they will pick up on it. Is nurtured in our children. When it comes to children, the second step, the development of humility, is more tricky to understand. This is where he starts to talk about the fact that as a parent you have authority, but how does it work to have authority as a parent at the same time be developing humility? I mean, you can't just let your kids walk all over you. That's the way people like to say it. You can't just defer to your children. I feel like I've passed through a generational period where that sort of thing was considered enlightened. But you don't discipline your children. You want to let them grow up as the nice little seeds that they are in the kindergarten, children garden. The idea, every seed has got what it needs. and you put it in the ground and you nurture it, you leave it alone, you don't try to dominate it or control it, and they will turn out fine. People aren't like that. Nobody's like that. Nobody, you know.
Flowers are obedient.
Flowers are obedient to whatever is in the seed. And animals have, what do you call them?
Instinct.
But there's no instinct to be human. To be a human being is to be free. And to be free means to choose that which is ultimately beyond us. To be free is to choose to be like God. That's the direction of freedom. Any other choice to be not like God in some way, to be like an animal, to be like a plant, just a couch potato, eating and watching, will not be a good thing for us, you know. Because we have a capacity to be free, to be a human being, to be a moral agent, to choose what is good and true and beautiful and will lead to life rather than death. And learning how to do that requires practicing virtues, cultivating purity of heart, and then when we find ourselves in a situation, we will be able to do what needs to be done. So, okay, the development of the second step, development of humility, tricky between parents and children. While we quite rightly expect our children will defer themselves to our will, it is much more difficult for us to accept that we must defer ourselves to them. Now, what does that mean? Parents cannot and should not defer themselves to their children with regard to simple, basic desires. That's the mistake, the liberal parenting. You know, say, oh, Johnny wants to do this, you know. And so what do? You end up teaching your children that they should follow their passions. And worse yet, that their passions are sacred. Johnny's passions and desires are sacred. Well, that's what they wanted to do. Didn't want to stifle them. Wanted them to be able to be themselves, you know. So all these basic desires, we all come with our own collection of basic desires. We encourage our children to be guided by those basic desires and passions. We know in advance how that's going to turn out. Most of us don't make that mistake, but I have known people who have been very rigorous about, exercised a lot of self-control in the effort to let that happen all by itself. A child who has developed a sense of the importance of purity of heart, which you don't get to by encouraging the expression of all passions and desires, a child who has developed a sense of the importance of purity of heart will know very little about how to actually develop it. He or she cannot, even if they want to, be a full participant in the work of setting aside the vices and pursuing the one goal of all Christians wholeheartedly. Children must be taught how to do this. And in the process of this teaching, parents must exercise substantial authority. The authoritative word is, you don't just give into your passions and desires. You have to develop self-control, restraint. This goes for the parents, of course, first of all, because they have to be practicing the virtues and cultivating purity of heart. If they're not doing that, it's a waste of time for parents to tell their children to do it. Do as I say, not as I do. That won't work. The exercise of authority may seem, when you first look at it, to make the exercise of humility an impossibility. This need not be the case. How do you do this? The central means by which we can develop humility while exercising parental authority is by practicing discretion in relation to our responses to our children. We can't count on our children to know the best ways to set aside their vices and seek love. Children can be incredibly puritanical once they get the idea of the things they need to not do and things they need to do. They will try to sometimes do that by force of will. Sometimes it's because their parents understand things in the same way. And it's not like that. It's not like that. That's not how we accomplish discretion. Discretion is key. You teach discretion by exercising discretion. Does anybody remember what discretion means?
Page 34, bottom line. One cannot possibly practice virtue without first recognizing through discretion whether one is acting, speaking, or thinking out of virtue or vice in a particular instance. So you need to be able to figure out whether you're acting out of virtue or vice. And this, you would think that it would be easy, but it's not. To develop a discretion, a person must establish a correct relationship with the best teachers around him, and you can see how that relates to spiritual parenting. I have a healthy distrust for their own judgment. Lacking the virtue of discretion, this person in the example preferred to be guided by his own judgment rather than obey counsels and conference of brothers and regulations of the elders. So it's holding back from following your passions and trying to evaluate the situation morally, not placing so much absolute confidence in your own judgment and holding yourself in such high esteem that you don't ask advice. And here's, you know, like Jimmy is saying, would you have good advisors around you? That can be a great help. So, discretion. Not being so cocksure of everything that I will learn by doing what I want to do and then I'll adjust it if when it turns out really bad. You don't have to do it that way. You know, you can exercise some caution. We have at least one child who only seems to learn that way, but it's not necessary. It has survived so far, which is kind of amazing.
The capacity to scrutinize all that he thinks, feels, and does, and hold it up against the standard of the truth.
And so how that applies to what we've just said here on the top of page 100, develop humility while exercising parental authority by practicing discretion in relation to our responses to our children.
One thing that I tried to do, especially when the girls were young, somehow it wasn't as easy with the boys, is there's no lying. That was like a, you know, and I know spanking is out of fashion now, but we're talking about the primordial days, you know, long, long ago. And when spanking was permitted, and the spanking offense was lying, because the idea is if there's lying, everything else goes. How could there be a relationship between parent and child when there's lying? And so my idea was to make sure that my children knew that I would do it, but never do it. That was like the ideal, you know, but never do it. But they had to know that I would do it, and I could convince them that I would, and I think I did. You know, there were occasions. And once one sees it happen to the other one, then the other one, you know, sometimes you can work that out. So you can get a lot of mileage out of one spanking. If it isn't the common punishment for who knows what, you know, you get a whooping, you know, that's not it. That won't work. So the idea is that you have a graduation in the way that you respond to things that your kids have done. If your response is, you disobeyed me, that's the ultimate, that won't work because it's based on authority. It's not based on love. It's not based on concern for the child as a person. It's not based on the pain that you feel by virtue of the fact that your child is doing something that is hurtful to themselves at a spiritual level. Like lying, which just dissolves the relationship between parents and children. So I think that's an example of discretion. I'm not putting it out there as the best possible example. It's just the way I approached it as a young parent. Lying breaks down everything. How can we talk if lying is going to be your response in order to avoid some punishment? But if the ultimate punishment is for lying, that was my thinking. Now, whether that's the best way or not, I don't know. But it's an example of trying to set up a situation where you are able to be discreet to try to have some intentional consciousness and awareness of what the child has done and how to deal with it. It's discretion. We can't count on our children to know the best ways to set aside their vices and seek love. Because of that, we must replace this knowledge on their part with our own understanding of what love requires. This work of replacement is accomplished if all the decisions we make on their behalf are driven wholly and exclusively by love. One of my lessons in this came when I became a priest. And having gotten out of seminary, especially St. Vladimir's, I knew pretty much everything, you know. So I went to my first parish and I would tell them, this is the way it is. And their job was to know and understand. It was a problem. And why was it a problem? The problem is right here. You must teach in love with discretion. You must not expect people to respond in a way that they are incapable of responding, because that's not where they're at. You have to start where people are at and then go beyond that and say, this is the next step. And then that needs to be the focus. And people are different. And the key to it, you know, like if you're talking to everybody at once or all your children at the same time, is that you have to adopt a tolerant attitude, not tolerant of doing things that ought not to be done, but tolerant in the sense that we don't all know exactly how to set aside vices and be virtuous. So we can't be judgmental in that kind of way, and yet at the same time, you can't just let everything go. You say, well, the kid is like a plant, it's going to develop however it's going to develop, and I'll just stand back and watch with amazement. That's...
You will be amazed.
Yeah, well, it's actually, it's everyone kind of predictable, you know, in a way. I mean, if you're going to grow weeds, weeds are a lot alike, which is kind of depressing. But I mean, if you let people be fed by their passions and desires, they will all be remarkably similar. They won't come out all different. Imagine that. Because you can only come out all different if you exercise discretion, if you pursue virtue. Then you will all develop in ways that are completely different, because everybody's got to deal with themselves and nobody's the same. We hear that a lot, but we don't recognize that that means that each person has a responsibility to deal with themselves that nobody can relieve them of. We each have to do that ourselves. And so we're trying to teach our children to do something with themselves that we also have tried to do with ourselves, up to the point that we can be wise enough to evaluate what can they stand to hear that will be helpful. What can be an encouragement for them to move in the right direction? And they may say no. But if my child was not misleading me, in the end, they will be able to figure out what the direction is that we have in mind. And if they choose to go that way, it's not a matter of a practical decision to do this or to do that. It's a matter of learning to exercise discretion. And it's remarkable how when somebody achieves a certain level of responsibility, all of a sudden it's like the wheels take hold and they're gone. They learned all this stuff you didn't even know they were learning. And they do much better than you ever thought they could. So they were learning all the time. This way it really works. So it's about, you have to preach in love. This is what Father Thomas Opko and Father Paul Laser taught me, and that I gradually learned. You can't impose on people the way they ought to be, even when they ask you to. The fullness of humility amounts to the submission of one's will to God rather than to another person. Each one of us learns that for themselves or not. We must ensure that we are motivating decisions entirely by real Christian love. And we have lots of alternatives that won't help. It is real Christian love, the kind of love we've described in this text so far. Therefore, motivated in turn by God, God is love, when we constantly exercise discretion with regard to the seemingly infinite decisions that we have to make about and for our children, and thus begin to submit ourselves to them in humility. What does that mean? This is what they need. Just this much. Not a whole ton of bricks dropped on their head out of frustration, but just we're guided by what they need to hear, what they're able to hear. And we look for the opportunity to tell them something that will be helpful. And they will be looking for it. And then when we give it to them, then it works out as it's supposed to work out. Similar to what we've explored already in the context of marriage, we ultimately realize that what is directing our choices for them is not our own fickle desire. It is something greater than ourselves as individuals. This Christian love has a will of its own. It is God. This Christian love has an orientation of its own, oriented ultimately telos, kingdom of God, and immediate goal, virtue. We're talking about learning how to be virtuous. It's not just a matter of applying a list of thou shalt nots. That can give you some guidance, but knowing how to go about being virtuous.
Gabriel Marcel called this creative fidelity. Fidelity to be faithful, not to abandon, not to betray. Christ, not to betray. Your husband, not to betray. Your wife. Creative fidelity, because you have to deal with concrete, particular, individual situations and do them in a way that does not betray God, does not betray your husband, does not betray your wife, does not betray your children. Okay. That's what we learn. That's what we learn.
Gabriel Marcel.
Marcel. M-A-R-C-E-L. He's a French philosopher, one of my favorite philosophers.
What we're talking about here is what he was talking about. This is what we have to learn. Orientation and movement in that direction.
Page 100, and I made a mark down where it says, we find ourselves astounded. That's where I'll pick up. So, what do you, am I communicating here? I might not be. I have trepidation. What do you think?
I think a lot of this stuff would be much better if he gave a lot more examples.
Yeah. The book would be much longer.
Yeah.
I
can read this stuff and it's like, well, yeah, that sounds good, but then how do you apply that?
Well, you know, I think part of the difficulty is that
that's where the discretion comes in.
Yeah.
Because it won't come to us in the same way that it came in that story, probably. It would be easy for, sometimes it might be easy for me to dismiss the story if the details aren't the same as it might say, well, that wouldn't work in my situation because what is there? So then I don't really have to struggle with my own need to do it the right way in that case.
We've spent a lot of time talking about discretion and still don't quite get it. Right? All of the situations that we find ourselves in are particular and specific. So we don't just, run into it and do whatever seems natural, guided by our passions and desires. That would be indiscreet. Right? So there's a clue.
There have been times, though, that the discretion, what I realize, and those of you know me, which is everyone except Lynn, that doesn't know that it's really easy for me to just fall into, try to live by rules. I've got a set of rules, and this is how we do it, and we do it that way. But I don't know. I shared with you, Father Jacob. It seems like it's nascent. It's a new idea for me. And it's through this paragraph, God is love, that really what the whole thing is about is we get everything else wrong. If we really love our children, if we really love God first and love our wives and our husbands and love our children, we can mess a lot of other things up. And the scripture says.
And not love them in a, I want them to be like me.
Right.
I want them to be an expression of myself. There are a lot of ways to love that are selfish and self-oriented, but this Christian love, yes, that's...
with the Apostle Paul, who said this, love covers a multitude of sins? I think it was the older Apostle Paul.
It's really critical to remember that without a struggle against vices, you can forget it. You will have no idea what to be discreet about.
You'll be blind.
The problem with rules is that they are so easily twisted in order to justify whatever it is we want to do. That's the problem with rules. So we find ourselves astounded to be learning something from our children.
Oh, I've seen that happen. Where I have been in places where I feel like what I'm doing is trying to teach Benjamin. I'm looking behind me and I'm saying, Ben, where are you? He says, I'm here, Dad. I look up and I realize, he's up in front of me. I thought I was teaching him, but he's up there, he's ahead of me on the road in this area already. So, and it's like he points out, that doesn't mean in all areas. These children, they still need your help in other areas. Young men, young women. But to see Benjamin in some ways because of his quiet spirit and his ability to listen, and he's gained things that for those of us who just want to spend our lives running our mouths, we don't pick things up as easily. Whereas I've seen Benjamin pick things up that, and he's given me a short an answer to something. Oh, that's it. Yeah, you've grasped it already. You just taught me something. So I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to learn from our children. You know, I've experienced that, and it's been, and not just from Benjamin, from some of my other children in different ways. But it's amazing. It's satisfying to see that happen. So I don't mind it. I like it. You're ahead of me. That's great.
We find ourselves asking forgiveness even from a child too small to speak because of some offense that if we don't do that, they might think it's okay for us to do that. After all, we're parents and they're little. They might think it's okay. And so, I mean, that's why we ask forgiveness, I think, because we don't want to wound them and to teach them that this is something that is okay. We want them to know this is not okay. And they will know, I mean, they will have been hurt. But children can accept hurt as their due. It wounds their spirit. So when we see that they've been hurt and we love them, we ask forgiveness from them, they are guiding us in that way. We're learning something from another person, from a child.
Forgiveness.
Right. And that this is a thing that I ought not to have done, specifically and particularly, that particular thing we've learned. We see God's will guiding us and our children by way of this love, as we submit ourselves to this love in humility. I think that's got it nailed down, you know, right there. Our children, in turn, often begin ever more readily to submit their wills in obedience to us as parents. Another thing here, too, is that kids can tell when we're putting it on, when we're making believe. We can speak to them in a gentle voice and pretend humility that we don't have, and they will learn to fake talk to get around things. I wrote to myself here, faking humility leads to a cynical child who learns that it's okay to fake it. And there's a lie there because we're not being straight with them. We shouldn't do that. Lying is never okay in that particular kind of way. To pretend to be humble when we're not, when we're actually trying to exert our authority over them. It has to be genuine humility. Turned over to the direction of love, our children's natural inclination to experiment with disobedience is remarkably assuaged. It's not as bad. It's lessened, though probably not eliminated. If we have succeeded in helping them to desire purity of heart, and you see, if we lie about ourselves to them, where's the purity of heart? It's gone. We're just trying to manipulate them, and they will know it. So we have to be honest with them. Helping them to desire purity of heart first, and we too direct ourselves to the will of God, who is love. So if we direct ourselves to the will of God, who is love, then our children see that by way of their submission to us, love grows more manifest in ourselves and our home. So it's not a technique. It can't be faked. If we and our children submit to one another by first directing ourselves to the love that is shared purity of heart, then, in spite of our parental responsibility to exercise power and make decisions, real humility and thus unity of purpose is indeed possible between parent and child. If we and our children submit to one another by first directing ourselves to shared purity of heart. Okay. As with all things in life, developing unity of purpose with our children is a messy and difficult process. It's not an authoritarian business. I say do this and you do it, and if you don't do it, you're punished. This is completely different. That's a nice, clean, dictatorial process. This isn't. One of the reasons that this is such a difficult process is not least of all because establishing the virtue of discretion in oneself is a profoundly difficult task, and developing unity of purpose with one's children relies heavily on the virtue's presence in the Christian parent. As with marriage, the kingdom of God can become present in our relationships with our children through unity of purpose. In the middle of page 102. As Orthodox Christians, we do not desire for our children the success of this world, nor failure, riches, nor poverty, fame, nor anonymity, lack of fame, but rather we desire only that this love, the kingdom, will grow within them and within us eternally. That's what we have in common with them. When the only desire we have left for our children and they for us is the purity of heart that welcomes this kingdom, then we have come to the unity of purpose that Abba Joseph tells us is the beginning of the genuine love that is God Himself. A family united by a single purpose is a family in which the first seeds of love have been planted. Mothers and fathers loving one another is critical here. Now, I learned that from my parents, and they were not saints, but they loved each other. And that was a lesson I learned. The presence of these seeds of love is an absolute prerequisite to a Christian family becoming a tool for seeking the kingdom on the part of all its members. Those moments in which we see real love do not last forever and don't sustain themselves without effort on our part. Love is difficult to foster, to encourage, to grow. Yet there are a few unique aspects of family life that make it especially possible to cultivate love. To some of these ways of cultivating love in family life, we turn now. The specifics all, I think, have to do with dealing with our own spiritual life. That's where the specifics are. If it were a technique, then examples would help. It's being admitted and suggested here that the problem for our children and for ourselves is learning how to go about this. Well, you learn how to go about it by doing it. You work on your, like if you're in NA, you work the steps. You deal with your vices. That's concrete. It's specific enough. Besides, our vices are different from one person to another. The way in which we're attached to them is different from one person to another. How we can go about contradicting them is different in one person's life or another person's life. Usually it has something to do with other people. There are loads of, but the examples, all you need to do is live through the next 24 hours, and examples will be provided. And if you ask God in particular for examples of a particular kind, probably you will get what you ask for. God, teach me to be humble. Opportunities will all of a sudden pop up all over the place.
Backing away from you.
I'm backing away from you.
Oh, okay. God, teach me how to curb my anger. You've got to have anger to deal with, right? I mean, it's virtue and vice. I mean, how simple can you get? It's not complicated. We make it complicated when we start trotting out the excuses, some of which are probably rules. Thank you. Okay, you pick up there next time, top of page 103.